7 weeks before I was born on the final day of 1967, Phil Donahue debuted his talk show in Dayton, Ohio. A little over 3 years later, Donahue was syndicated nationwide. The show created a new mold for daytime talk programs, with its audience participation and exploration of controversial issues.
This is Sam. Sam is crazy about me. What is not so funny is that Sam has been tested HIV positive. That means he has the AIDS virus.
And then at the Betty Ford Clinic, you got up on one occasion, you said, I'm Elizabeth Taylor, I'm an addict and an alcoholic. You were taking Valium, sleeping pills, and Jack Daniel.
It's a wonder I didn't kill myself.
Here is another drama. These people are gypsies.
She wants her husband to know she's having sex with his brother.
She encourages you to kill your grandfather.
You can use butter or margarine. I prefer the margarine.
You were artificially inseminated with the sperm of your brother.
As you look back on it now, is it possible that you drove your mother crazy? I don't know. I'm asking.
Yes, we really are identical twin brothers.
After a 29-year run and nearly 7,000 one-hour daily shows, the final episode of Donahue aired on September 13, 1996, culminating what remains the longest continuous run of any syndicated talk show in U.S. television history. Donahue is a legend, a pioneer. He has been awarded 20 Emmy Awards during his broadcasting career, 10 as host and 10 for the show itself. He's also the recipient of the prestigious Peabody Award. To our knowledge, we are not related. Over the next 90 minutes, we'll talk with Phil Donahue about his broadcasting career, politics, ratings, religion, and because it is now law to do so, Donald Trump. It is one of the great thrills of my career to welcome Phil Donahue to the roundtable. What a pleasure.
My pleasure, Joe. Pleased to be here.
Thank you very, very much. It would seem to me, since your retirement from The Daily Show and then, of course, the brief stint on MSNBC, that there has to be a point when something like the election of Donald Trump just says to you, oh, God, I wish I were on television still.
Well, there is. That itch is there. and I assure you that if I had a show, I would feature Donald Trump and do whatever I could to get him on my show. Although I'm not so sure I'd be successful now. He appeared on my television show three times.
Three times, right.
I thought he was a hot dog then. In many ways, I kind of stiff-armed him.
Welfare cases ruined his buildings. Isn't that... aren't you pretty
close here to looking like
an insensitive guy from atop your Trump Tower looking down on the Woolman Rink over the vast holdings of your own empire? Shouldn't we have just a little more understanding from
Absolutely.
A man of your influence and wealth on the issue of making New York livable for all of us, safety on the subway,
if
the answer is absolutely, then we can't continue to give you guys these big tax breaks. And that would go for General Electric and NBC, too. You tell us in your own book that you would make money on the Trump Tower in New York
but when everybody
without
else is
the tax breaks.
So when everybody else in the city gets it but Donald Trump, when Koch and the administration tries to stop Donald Trump, and I don't say give me the tax breaks, I say don't give everyone else the tax breaks. If every other building being built in New York City is entitled to a residential tax abatement and Trump Tower goes and I'm not entitled, I'm the only building in the city of New York that's not entitled, I don't think that's a problem.
Look at the location of your building.
What difference does it make? There are other wonderful locations. Phil, there are other wonderful locations also that are also getting tax abatements. I won the case. They didn't give it to me. It took me 2.5 years in court. I won it 7-0 in 3 different courts, and I'm very happy about it. I didn't win it because I so much needed it as much as because on a moral principle I was entitled to it. If nobody's going to get it, I'm satisfied. If everybody's going to get it, I shouldn't be the only one that's not getting it, Phil. And I know you well enough to know that you wouldn't take it either. If you were in my position, you wouldn't take that. So that's what happened.
Hey, let's hear it for the rich folks.
And he was an entertainer then. I mean, he drew a crowd. Nothing boring about Donald Trump. At the time, he collected celebrities. You know, he wanted to be surrounded by them. Although I must say, I was not invited to Mar-a-Lago, and I was not invited to his wedding. I think he was married to Marla at that time, Marla Maples.
Yeah.
So we have a checkered history. I wasn't a fan, and I think he knew that.
The interesting aspect of it, well, there's two interesting aspects, at least that I find. One, in watching that interview from 1987, you see many of the same themes that he uses today, going after the Chinese, keeping jobs in this country, the average worker. He talked a lot about that on your show.
Yes, he was very outspoken. The Japanese are taking advantage of us. And he was a big, big spokesman for those who felt aggrieved that we were not keeping up with the unfair competition of other countries. Mm. Big deal with him.
You know what it is? I don't like being taken advantage of, okay? And when I see a Japan ripping off this country, and I'm not saying that negative to Japan. I'm saying it from my standpoint. I'm a businessman. I know how to deal, and some of you folks do too. When I see a total ripoff of this country by Japan, where they literally have no defense budget, where we have to borrow money from them in order to get them oil and defend the Persian Gulf, where most of the oil goes to Japan and other countries, not us. We get 4% of our oil. When I see Kuwait, a total ripoff, we're bringing the Bridgeton. You remember the Bridgeton? Their oil minister sat back and he laughed at how much money he's going to make. Why aren't we getting some of that money? Why aren't we getting it?
That's very similar to what he's talking about today.
Many look at that period of time and say, well, we can't figure out what he was politically. Was he a Democrat then? Was he giving money to Democratic sources? And forgive this, but my God, if you don't know, who would, right? I don't
Well, I certainly am not inside baseball Trump, but I think your observation is quite correct. He was a benefactor to all political parties and persuasions. He was a showman at that time. One of the big things he did was he actually built Woolman Rink in Central Park.
Right.
He took it over.
You take a look at the city of New York, they can't build an ice skating rink. An ice skating rink was under construction, I guess, for a period of 7 years, the Woolman Skating Rink in Central Park, and they couldn't build it. They spent $12 or $14 million, was supposed to cost two. And we did it for in about 4 months, as you know, for
a
very small amount of money.
It's a big success story, no doubt about it. You came in and came in under, and you did it in months when the city was fooling around. It was a very interesting statement on government bureaucracy, et cetera, et cetera. And boy, you looked like a Republican businessman standing there when they cut the ribbon. But who's to complain? They're skating as we speak.
He was the man who could do it cheaper, faster, better.
You said on that show that you felt, you at one point, it was when the book came out, The Art of the Deal, and you looked up at him and you say, you know, I think I like your old man more than I like you.
I did say that. And he shook his head in agreement. His father was he collected scraps of wood at the end of the carpenter's day. Just as an anecdote about him, he was frugal. If there was any way to save this trapezoid figured piece of wood for the next project, he would have it and save it and use it. And little Donald Trump was often at the site observing all this. And so he picked up a lot from his dad. His dad was nowhere near the hot dog that young Donald became when he became a businessman who put his name on the side of everything he built.
You're listening to the Roundtable special extended interview with TV fixture and pioneer Phil Donahue. Let me tap into your expertise in the media, and having been a person for decades, knew how to put on a show and to get big ratings and to put eyeballs onto a television set. What the hell happened to us as a nation that we went and said, this is the guy who can lead us over the next 4, maybe 8 years?
Well, I think the first thing we have to observe or make note of is a small percentage of the voting public put Donald Trump in the Oval Office. It was hardly a landslide victory. In fact, the people who worked very hard for Hillary want you to know that he did not win the majority of the voters. But he certainly has to be credited with a totally unpredicted victory that him placed him in the highest office in our country. This is, as the boys in the press bar would say, one hell of a story, and remains so. I think he is the product of a rebellion. I think he is the product of a revolution light. Revolution without the gunfire and without the bodies in the streets and without the storming of the palace. I had a lot of curiosity as he walked out on that stage during the rallies, and you saw all those, first of all, big applause, not an empty seat.
Right.
He comes out applauding for himself. And all those people up front that you saw the back of their heads from the camera position that was behind them focused on Donald Trump as he entered. Almost all of those people in the front rows had cell phones, which they raised above their heads and took his picture like he was a rock star. And I was very curious, who are these people? And I think that's where perhaps, you got to be careful here, mainstream media failed us. They were so focused on the candidates, Hillary's server in the basement of her home, all these shiny subjects and shiny objects distracted them. What I thought was a major feature of this story. Who was voting for Donald Trump? Who filled the stadiums at those rallies? Who are these people? And of course, I'm not a genius, and I hardly predicted this, but I think these people were made up of working class people who feel that their country has failed them, has stopped paying attention to them. These are the people who have young adult children who can't find a job. These are the people who can't get a raise in the minimum starvation wage. These are the people whose young adult children can't pay back their college loans. And suddenly, this guy jumps out of a cake and says, this government is taking advantage of you. This government is screwing you. And they stand up and say, yeah, as almost a middle finger, really, raised to the elite media, the elite political class that has a lot better health care insurance than they do. And the vote for Donald Trump was a rebellion. It was a, yeah, take this, with profanity thrown in. Finally, they got attention. This is the way they did it. If you think about it, it was a brilliant strategy undertaken by the powerless people in this country. And let's remember this. A lot of nice people voted for Donald Trump. I'll bet you there's just about every family that has at least one member who voted for Donald Trump. Often blue collar, often working for a company that they hear is going to move to China. And he erupts with his speech that you heard him give on my program in 1987. They're taking advantage of us. The Japanese are ripping us off, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And these were people not in that basket of deplorables, as Hillary Clinton maintained, but people, as you say, who were there in the primaries. They were there at the beginning. They were there state to state to state. And as you also indicated, it's a hell of a story. Do you think we know now what that story is? Because it seems like we're still chasing it.
Isn't it interesting? First of all, it's very difficult for the human animal to admit that he was wrong. I believe that most of the people who voted for Donald Trump will never acknowledge the mistake they've made. He's Elvis. He can get on his big old airplane, fly to any location in this country that'll accept the plane, big enough airport. He'll get off that plane and get into one of the four black long cars that will await him on the tarmac and drive to the largest venue within a certain radius and walk out to a totally packed auditorium, maybe a stadium. And the people will rise, applaud, take his picture as he walks out.
The Boy Scouts, though, Phil, the Boy Scouts.
A huge mistake and a very truthful reflection of how much he is out of touch. This is a crotch grabber.
Mm-hmm.
And can you expect anything else from a crotch grabber? It never occurred to him that these are 13-year-old boys. And he's treating them like he's at the American Legion Hall. All of this it's coming down on us pretty hard. Now, does that mean some who voted for him are sorry now? I believe some are. But I don't know how many are, and neither do you, and I don't know how you measure that. It's true that his approval rating is at a historic low, apparently, for a president at this time. But that survey is taken among, say, 100 people, only 12 of whom, or 15, voted for him. So you're getting a read from people who didn't vote. And David Leonhardt of the New York Times had a wonderful article in which he makes the point that Donald Trump was elected by the people who didn't vote. You know, God bless the conservatives. They vote. I don't know what's wrong with the so-called progressives. By the way, I'm a progressive now. I'm not a liberal. I'm a progressive. We're so ashamed of the L word that we've changed our name. We're progressives now. So excuse you for breathing. progressives. I mean, the nuns who taught me at Our Lady of Angels School on Cleveland's West Side never thought of me as a progressive. But it is true that surveys taken now include countless numbers of people who were not part of the game in November. They didn't vote. It's shameful, really.
We call ourselves patriots, and yet we're not out there voting. More than half of us are not out there voting.
That is true, and it is shameful.
That is the hypocrisy.
It takes hypocrisy to another level. America, America, proud to be an American. And by the way, we can't get over congratulating ourselves, the leader of the free world, the last remaining superpower. I mean, you know, if a bully talked like that in the playground, somebody would beat the hell out of him. You do not triumph in victory. I think we are exceptional. This is a fabulous idea, this thing called the United States of America. It's a wonderful idea. But I think it's better if someone from another country says that about us. Do not triumph in victory. You look foolish. I just think that it's this jingoism that's gotten us into so much trouble around the world. But here we are.
So let me ask Phil Donahue, the progressive, are we going to be okay?
You know, it's not possible to say yes. It's not possible to say anything but yes, because, you know, it is hard to believe that we're at the end of this wonderful experiment. But as someone who long before me said, you know, if everything good must come to an end, then everything will. And we have no guarantee. We're spending $2 billion a day, on things that go boom. You don't get a statue in a park for fixing health care. You don't get a statue in a park for fixing the infrastructure. You only get a statue in the park for war. That's why all the men in statues in the park have a sword in their hand, right, or they're on a horse.
On a horse.
And you know, that's, kids play on cannons in parks. We put cannons in parks.
Sure.
And in some communities, old World War II fighter planes. We've become a warrior nation. And while we're doing this, we're looking up to realize that we haven't, as you might say, won a war in a long, long time. And it's got us a little crazy. And so we're entering more and more conflicts to prove all those things we're saying are true. And yet, I'm not here to say, ain't it awful? I learned a long time ago, people turn you off if you say that enough. And it is certainly true. For example, at the end of World War II, the Marshall Plan, we rebuilt Europe, and we certainly prevailed in the Far East. And there's a lot about America that is noble. It's just as the years go by, it's getting more and more difficult for nobility to express itself. We have too many people in this country who would rather win a war than avoid one. There's no glory in peace, it seems. There's only glory in military victory. And we keep chasing it. And we've put our young adult children at risk. We have over 6,000 dead in Iraq, Afghanistan. And are we safer? And we're canonizing troops, the wonderful troops, the brave troops, the heroic troops. The troops come home and the VA doesn't call them back. And that is the ultimate hypocrisy. And I ought to know this, it's awfully hard to dissent in America today. There are millions of Americans who believe that if a president is calling a war, you have to shut up and sing. And all that bloodshed to give us the freedom, the most important, one of the most important freedoms we have, to dissent. And when we need it the most, we're told not to use it. There are millions of Americans who think that if you criticize a president while he's ramping up for war, you don't love America. The incoming pressure to not dissent is enormous, to the point where I lost a job because I thought the invasion of Iraq was not a good idea. So all these things conspire to lead to war. The only thing separating us from Canada is an imaginary line. And when somebody launches an attack somewhere in the world, they don't rise up and say, we got to go get them. America does. I think it's a shame because we gave so much to the world. Automotive engineering, aviation, illumination, atomic energy. We're the only country in the world who dropped an atom bomb on real live people twice. You know, we don't talk about that. All these old men in Washington sending your kid to war to prove that they're tough. The chicken hawks. Shameful. Shameful. And many of them are still there, telling their constituents how tough America is. I don't get it. I don't get it. It's going to take a lot to, it's like moving a ship. We got an aircraft carrier, which cost us $20 billion. And 19 guys with box cutters brought this nation to its knees. As the song they sang in the Vietnam War said, when will they ever learn?
Let's pause there. We are speaking with Phil Donahue. When we return in our next hour, we're going to talk with Phil Donahue about the highs and lows of his Emmy Award-winning talk show, and continue our conversation this morning. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our guest this morning is talk show legend Phil Donahue. His show was born in 1967 in Dayton, Ohio. That show quickly gained a following as a forum for hot-button social issues of the day. Donahue went on to have numerous high-profile guests over the years, including Ronald Reagan, Nelson Mandela, Jane Fonda. However, he remained most popular for his devotion to controversial issues, touching on the matters of women's rights.
Yes,
I am tired of not being able to be proud that I am a homemaker. I am sick and tired of having to feel that if I don't work and I choose to stay home and raise my children, that I am a failure.
Well, the hell with the people who say that!
Yeah, well, the country is going down the drain because there's no parents to watch their children. There's no parental guidance anywhere.
Yeah.
You have to stay home. You have to be proud to be a parent.
Yeah. But why are you so victimized by someone else's attitude? All that matters is what you know.
Because I live in New York and everybody I know is a yuppie and they all have to work and they make me feel like garbage.
Homosexuality.
How did you feel when you learned that your brother was gay?
It's been an incredible, incredible thing between us. It brought us much, much closer.
Yeah, but how did you feel at the moment he told you?
I was floored.
Floored? Disappointed?
Not disappointed at all, because I basically thought I was the only one in the family. And to find out that I had someone else in the family who was, that I could share my thoughts and feelings with, made a great deal of difference in my life. It made me feel much more comfortable, and it made me feel like that somebody in the family I could converse
right.
with.
And misdeeds of the Catholic Church.
It'll never die. It will always be with it, but it will be indefinitely crippled.
Until it changes.
As long as you have to be celibate to serve as a male religious under the work of the Holy Order.
The first week of his show set the tone for the nearly 30 years that would follow. His first guest was the atheist, Madeline Murray O'Hare.
Your grief is not assuaged as would be the religionist who believes that there is another place where happiness will again be abundant.
Oh, that's a big lollipop.
I know you don't believe that. I'm asking.
We must look at them, and we never say they've passed over or they're gone to their reward or they have been transported or anything else. People are dead.
He followed that with an obstetrician showing film of the birth of a baby. Donahue talked about funerals, and he reclined in a coffin on Thursday's broadcast, and by Friday, he was showing an anatomically correct little brother doll, which he showed to the camera, sans diaper, asking, is this toy objectionable? Phil Donahue, again, great to have you with us.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
Well, clear from the beginning, this was not the Johnny Gilbert show. Johnny Gilbert, who is now still the announcer for Jeopardy, was the guy you replaced in Dayton, Ohio.
This is Jeopardy. That's Johnny Gilbert. Nice man.
His audience shows up thinking they're going to see his show, and there's Phil Donahue with arguably at that time the most hated woman in America.
She loved that definition. And she was. You know, they say nobody goes for a beer during a hockey fight. Nobody left the Donahue show when Madeline was on. She put her elbows on the table across from me, like, you know, 3 minutes into the show. And she said to the host who had 10 years earlier graduated from the University of Notre Dame, she leaned forward and said, there is no God. There's no heaven, there's no hell, there are no angels. When you die, you go in the ground, you biodegrade, and you become part of the physical universe. Well, the building fell in Dayton, Ohio. I got a lot of holy pictures. A lot of people were praying for me. Sponsors canceled. But they knew there was this new show on the air in Dayton, Ohio. You know, Dayton is not on a navigable river. Dayton is a town built on brains. When we began our show in 1967, there were 5 General Motors plants in Dayton. It was the home of NCR, National Cash Register Company. Charles Kettering invented the starter motor. And did I mention the Wright brothers?
Right.
So the Dayton audience accepted the show. That was my first big break. In many ways, I am a lucky duck, really. I just got very lucky. We knew that our show was visually boring. 2 talking heads, ho-hum. And we were up against Monty Hall, who was giving away $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich, you know, and the spinning wheels, and come on down. And here I am talking to Madeline Murray O'Hare and holding up, you mentioned, the anatomically correct doll. And then a little tallywhacker all visible right there between his legs. Is this doll objectionable for children? Call Baldwin 75 if you think so. If you don't, well, Baldwin 6. Blah, blah. The entire Baldwin exchange went out, collapsed. First week we were on the air. Put a real live homosexual right here on my show. And, of course, mothers thought their kids would catch it. Nobody was out in 1967. Why are we aggrandizing this man by putting him on television? More sponsors canceled. These are salesmen, you know, just lost some of their most important accounts. I mean, it's hard to give a guy who's got 2.5 kids a freedom of speech lesson, you know, when he's getting hit in the pocketbook. But we had a general manager who hung in there. He didn't drop his tools and run. And the ratings were going through the roof. That's how we got noticed in Dayton, Ohio. And you mentioned Johnny Gilbert. I inherited his audience. And, you know, people with a ticket to see the Johnny Gilbert show, which was, you know, singing, you could wave, you could win prizes. And here come these ticket holders, and we sat them down on folding chairs. I think we had two cameras. And about the third show, they were rumbling during the commercials. I could hear them. And like, you know, slow learner that I am, by the fourth show, I jumped out of the set and ran to the audience with a mic that was hardwired. And, you know, I would strangle three people in the front row trying to get back to the back row. But they would, you know, they would stand up. And we had a mother she was a Quaker, whose daughter was starving on a hunger strike in the Greene County Jail, Xenia, in Dayton, suburban Dayton, Ohio, outside of Dayton, to protest the Vietnam War. She's from Antioch College. And the mothers in the audience were just hysterical. Well, what if she dies, they said. And the mother would say, why aren't you worrying about the people who are dying now in this Southeast Asian meaningless war? Why don't you care about these people, young, mostly men, coming home in plastic zipper bags? But she's your daughter. And I couldn't get to them fast enough. And we suddenly had something on the air that nobody else had. And the phones were buzzing with people. All the lines were blinking from people who were trying to get in to tell us what they thought about this hunger strike and the Quakers who weren't really Americans. And they were, why don't they go to Russia if they're not happy? You know, stuff like this. Suddenly we were hot. And then the publishing industry discovered us. And if you had written a book, you wanted to be on my show because you're on for an hour. So suddenly we were making noise. We got into, you know, four markets and then two and then six. And we finally started to climb. And then New York and Los Angeles discovered us. And when we got into New York, you know, I don't know, 3 weeks later, I was in the cover of Newsweek.
Talk show legend Phil Donahue is our guest on this morning's roundtable, sharing with us stories from his remarkable decades-long career.
What I find interesting, though, you were doing this in 1967, and we were having a conversation of Phil Donahue putting on a homosexual is the degradation of our culture and our society worth good ratings. Well, then, all these years later, decades, 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 Megyn Kelly has on Alex Jones, and we're saying and asking the same damn thing. Is it worth putting that viewpoint on the air for the sake of ratings or simply to inform the public that this person with this ideology exists?
Well, first things first, Joe, to tell you what you already know, the coin of the realm of what we do is the size of our audience.
Correct.
If people aren't listening, no sense talking.
But to the overall question of what it takes to get those people watching and at what expense, because when you put on the strippers, when you, oh, Phil Donahue, you put on a skirt.
You hate this.
I hate it.
You hate it. Why do you hate it?
I don't know. You look odd.
I do?
Yeah. You don't look like Phil Donahue at all.
Great. What? Your butt looks great.
Thanks
in that dress.
220 shows a year, you picked this one to come to.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's not you.
Well, is that what it takes to get good ratings?
I wasn't that smart to know.
By that time, you were pretty smart. You knew what it was going to take.
Well, I knew it wasn't going to be boring, but I knew that tomorrow I'd be able to discuss the Syrian-Israeli borders dispute or, you know, heavy stuff. We could put on Dick Gephardt for an hour,
right,
which we did. Bob Dole. People, you know, like that. And we were able to attract people like Ayn Rand, which we did from the Madison Square Garden here, the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden. She made the audience gasp. She would not vote for a woman for president. She actually said that.
Do you believe that there is going to be a day where there's going to be a female in the White House as president? And how do you feel about that?
I wouldn't vote for her.
You would or wouldn't?
Would not.
You would not?
No.
Why not?
For many reasons. Yes.
Would you not vote for her because she was a woman, even if she were better qualified than any man?
If we had fallen that low, I might.
That low? I think you have a very, very
I'll
low
tell
opinion
you what,
of women.
Let me answer this. It is not to a woman's personal interest to rule men. It puts her in a very unhappy position. I don't believe that any good woman would want that position.
Ayn Rand. You know, if it wasn't for the skirt, you know, maybe we wouldn't be able to have Margaret Mead or the Nazi who marched in Skokie. You have to entertain the people. If you don't, you're going to be parking cars very shortly. You can't say, ain't it awful, 5 days a week. They just won't listen. But to get to your question, the roof fell in when Phil wore a skirt.
Emmy and Peabody Award-winning broadcaster Phil Donahue is our guest on this extended roundtable special on WAMC.
You were able to bring in, and it's just as you said, you're able to have a Dick Gephardt, you're able to have a Bob Dole, and you're able to have a conversation, but you're able to do those shows and do the other. The fascinating thing I found as a wannabe broadcaster and watching your show is that you didn't have a teleprompter. You didn't have cue cards. It was you, the guest, a microphone, and that audience. And with those four ingredients, there was trust on all sides. You trusted the audience. Can you imagine a host today walking up to a lady in the third row and putting a mic in her face and not know what's going to come out of her mouth? That doesn't happen anymore. And you did it. I mean, that's trust that you had in that audience.
Well, I never thought of it that way, but I guess that's right. We worked very hard to keep the audience with us. I was all over that studio during the commercials when we weren't on the air.
We're coming to the cheap seat, so stay awake back there. We want you in there. Don't worry about saying something stupid. I hold the record. You can't top me. This is the best audience we have ever had. My nose getting long? You're so much better than the crowd we had here yesterday. They were drinking cheap wine out of a brown paper bag. How much time we got? What? Seconds?
Oh, I have to go to the bathroom.
Come on, give me some help now. I would touch them on the back. I would grab their hand and maybe even squeeze it. And, you know, suggest to them that, hey, I do this every day. You can do this now. Come on, get in. We were also pretty good at making sure people didn't take us around the world verbally. We prepared our callers. You know, please don't tell Phil how wonderful his show is. Just get right to your question. And people are nervous, and it's hard. And most people, are when they're nervous, they talk too much. Not unlike Phil Donahue from West Cleveland. And so we were pretty good. We turned the tally lights off of the cameras. So when we, and we're, this is another feature we're very proud of. We picked off people in the audience with our cameras while the guest was speaking. So you saw a reaction.
Live reaction.
Yeah. And it just created the community that we wanted to develop between me, the guest, the callers, and the studio audience. Those were the best shows. When the callers were alive and had some emotion behind what they were saying, and the hands were all over the studio audience where I couldn't get to them fast enough. The clock is ticking. This is valuable time. And by the way, I was never introduced. The floor, usually a woman, floor director, cued me and we just went. Go. We didn't say, welcome. I wasn't introduced to a thunderous ovation from my audience. We just thought that was taking up time that we needed for the, we even continued during the credits at the end of the show.
I love that about the show.
Well, I thought this is the most valuable time you can imagine. Don't waste it. Let's get everybody in that we can. And if people are going to be loyal enough to come and come up to the eighth floor at 30 Rockefeller Center after fighting the traffic and paying the cab fare, whatever it was, we wanted to try and get as many on as possible. And so that's the reason. So
you'd be sitting at home and you'd watch that, though, and you'd be going, oh, shut up about the Drake Hotel. This woman's asking a question yeah. that I want to hear the answer
right.
to.
That was the problem, man. That was the downside of this, because it was frustrating when, you know, a woman would stand up.
But it gave you the idea that now that I was watching the evening news, that you were still in New York and you were talking to those guests and talking to those people, and the conversation was going on. And that was, whether it was or wasn't, but it was reassuring.
Right.
So allow me to just for a moment, though, say that you were able to do this. And I mentioned the teleprompter, but that camera would go on and then you would go on. And there was in front of us a broadcaster, not a comedian, not an actor, a broadcaster, a person who had started in radio and in television and in news, was a journalist, was out on the tarmac with the best of them. And we don't have that anymore. The broadcaster who is actually, sure, there was a lot of showbiz in Phil Donahue, but at heart, a broadcaster.
Well, I've thought about that. You know, what did I do? I didn't sing. I wasn't a ventriloquist. Loath as I am to speak of myself, maybe there is something to this blarney among the Irish. I wasn't a bad communicator. But it's, you know, I had a lot of help too, Joe. I had 10, 12 women outside my office door, mostly women, who would come into my office with some ideas. They caught on to what we were up to very fast. And many of the ideas they brought me, I kind of winced. I didn't think it was very good and turned out to be a wonderful show. So I learned a long time ago that I don't have a corner on the market of great ideas. It was a woman who brought me the idea of the male stripper, for example. I mean, I didn't think of that. My first question was, where are we going to put the microphone? And I mean, I stood in the audience while these guys who pump, you know, every day, came out and start tearing their shirts off. One guy was doing the limbo, you know, where you go under the, and he set his jockstrap on fire. Well, I mean, I'm standing in the audience surrounded by your grandmother, your mother, your baby sister, and they are screaming with delight. This was in Boston. I couldn't believe what was happening. Our ratings were very good with that show, I have to tell you. What does it mean? I don't know. Today, people ask me, you know, how do you feel about what's happening to your talk show genre? And I say, well, I think of them, they're all my illegitimate children, and I love them all equally. We didn't think of Who's Your Daddy. We didn't think of that. I wonder if we'd have done it if we had. I don't know.
But you were saying this 20 years ago, that Sally, Ricky Lake, Faith Daniels, Geraldo, Montel, Maury Povich, the list goes on, that eventually those shows, if they're good, they're good, and if they're not, they're going to fall their own weight.
Very competitive arena.
And that's exactly what's happened. So we don't have, what do we have instead now? Well, we have Ellen. We have Harry Connick Jr. We don't have that type of issue program where people are coming out, right, not Who's Your Daddy, but Lauren Bacall that you had on, or let's face, one of my favorite shows that I've ever seen was you interviewing Katharine Hepburn in her apartment. And she didn't know who you were.
Oh, yeah.
And what's your name?
Geraldo Rivera. You don't know, do you? You don't know.
What?
I'll bet you don't know. And
no,
you're...
I don't.
Do you have any idea what this does to my ego? 24 years on the air, over 5,000 hours, and you don't know who the hell I am.
No.
This is very painful for me, but I'm going to tell you who I am.
Okay.
I'm Phil Donahue.
No, you're not.
We couldn't wait to get it on the air.
I bet.
It does occur to me that there's a widespread belief in our game today among the producers and the people who make the big decisions about what you see on TV, that the audience has a very short attention span. And what I noticed when I have been on some of these shows is that they're kind of a hybrid between a talk show and a game show. And 5 minutes into the interview with a guest who probably has a book or whatever it might be, or maybe a movie star, and there are people in the audience who are throwing a football through a swinging automobile tire to win a prize. So it's got to be fast-paced, visual entertainment that you're compelled to watch. And the last thing you want is two talking heads for the hour. Or as we did it, two talking heads and 200 people in the audience and the phone calls. I'm just wondering if the audience isn't prepared to watch more what we might call serious subjects than our industry gives them credit for. Now, you got to watch me. I was always a little appalled at the old guys who came, you know, on my show and other shows down through the length of my career and lamented how it was so much better in my day. Believe me, in my day. And I'm trying not to do that. I thought it was always kind of grand of them to say that. And I'm here saying it, that I do think we sure need a lot more heavy business than the hee-hee-ha-has that were so much a part of television in those days. And we see a lot of that today. Apparently, the surveys show that the most important feature of a successful television personality is likability. This is why the weatherman and the anchor person kibitz. They either end the weather with a little funnyism that triggers laughter on the part of the straight news readers,
right,
and the weatherman is hee hee ha ha, because they know that that is what attracts the viewer. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Roundtable special interview with talk show pioneer Phil Donahue. Donahue won many Emmys for his show, met his wife, actress Marlo Thomas, on the program, and changed the landscape of television along the way.
When you came on the air, when you hit your stride, your peak, Dinah Shore, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas from the city of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. much like the shows, the entertainment shows that we're seeing today.
And very successful.
And very successful. And you come in and you do something different. So we can only assume that this is cyclical. And at some point, a young man or woman from Dayton or elsewhere will arrive and start talking about stuff again.
I hope you're right, Joe. I hope you're right. Wouldn't that be great? And I admire your optimism. I probably the pendulum will swing. And let's not be so grand as to criticize the winners today. I mean, Ellen's doing a lot of good work with her very large audience. Even Rachel Ray, you know? I miss Regis.
Another great broadcaster.
A wonderful guy. He could spin cotton candy out of nothing. He was able to entertain. He made people laugh. I admire him very much. When I'm in an airport with my wife, Marlo, people knock me over to get to Marlo. And they just gush, you know, oh, Miss Thomas, Free to Be was such a... My children wore out the record. Mm-hmm. And that girl, whatever happened to Donald? And the hospital, your father, St. Jude, I just think, and I'm standing there. Finally, somebody will recognize me, and they say, oh, we like you too, Merv. So I learned some time ago that fame is fleeting.
I remember you, this is years ago. This is in, I want to say it was 1984 or 5, and you were doing a series of shows in Philadelphia, which is where I was a senior in high school at that point. And I went to go see your show, and I stayed after till you came out. It was at the Devon, Pennsylvania, at the Valley Forge Music Fair. And there was a group of us out there waiting for
who
you.
Who was the guest? Do you remember?
I do remember who the guest was. It was, do I remember? It was on the welfare system. And as you walked out, just the group of people there erupted. And I turned to you and I said, God, that must make you feel good. And you said, the thing that worries me is when you get on a bus or a train and people don't know who you are, and then you just start humming your theme song.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a pretty good story that goes with that, and I'm happy to share it with you. You got 1 second?
I do.
This is the Weekend Weatherman. He's on the air once a week, 11:25 on Saturday night, after the news. He's got, what do you have after commercials? What, you got 3.5 minutes, maybe.
Right.
And he's with the highs and the lows and the warm front coming in and the rain on Thursday. And he's in the supermarket one Sunday morning, and he notices two women over by the produce counter looking at him and talking. And he decides, you know, he just walks right over to him. He says, you know, somewhere along the way, the rumor got out that celebrities don't like to be recognized. Well, that's not me. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be me. I mean, treat me like your next-door neighbor. You want a selfie, I'm happy to oblige. And by the way, I'm happy to speak to your children's school. Meteorology is a fast-growing science, and if you turn young people onto it early enough, they'll become very, very excited, and it's a wonderful career. And one of the women leaned forward to him, and she said, you have our cart. So, all the time, you're brought down. So it's good for you, you know? It's not likely I'll become too egomaniacal, so let's hope not.
With that said, how hard was it to walk away? I mean, I know the commercial pressures, obviously, but there's still, you had that forum for almost 30 years. Yeah, I mean, stations were leaving, and it became the market forces. But how hard for you personally was it not to have that forum every day, And to walk into that studio, whether it was 8G in the NBC building in New York or wherever.
I'll tell you, Joe, it wasn't that hard, really. You know, after over 5,000 shows, a little voice says, okay, they've heard you speak, now sit down. I don't want to complain because, I worked in a steel mill when I was 17 years old, and I saw what work really was. So no telethons for me, but I was glad to go. You know, the tie and the shirt every day and going out there, and, you know, it's a scary thing. You can bomb. I didn't hit a home run every day. And I felt an obligation to the people, the women, mostly women, who produced the show, to do the best I can to make it what they envisioned it to be. If a show didn't work, often it was my fault. So that's pressure. I don't know, I looked forward to not having to jump out of a cake every day. Although I did go back, as you may know.
In 2002.
And had a short, unhappy life at MSNBC.
Any more protesters taking on the government? Is there a place for them in this post-9/11 world, or are they just downright unpatriotic?
The same station, by the way. Well, the same company. I had a show with Vladimir Posner
at CNBC,
CNBC in Fort Lee. We did that for almost 5 years, and I enjoyed it. We worked for Roger Ailes, me and the communist, Vladimir Posner. What a ride that was.
Jack Parr famously said that, as he ended his career, said, look, I've said everything I've had to say twice.
Very good. He was clever.
So I assume you got to that point. But really, you did come back, and I do want to talk about that. But you came back, but after that, you seemed like you seemed comfortable not being, as you say, jumping out of the cake. You don't have to be. It's fascinating to me watching Letterman now after 30 years. He'll pop up and do an event at the 92nd Street Y, or he'll host this or host that, and it seems to be gets a taste of it, but that's enough.
And I do enjoy being invited and asked, actually. I mean, it's flattering to think you might have something to say. But, you know, also, I'll be 82 in December. Don't fuss. I have ties. And I need all. That's all I don't need anymore.
You're okay?
I'm okay.
All right.
I tell you, there's not a big market for the dissenter like I have been pegged to be. They let me alone pretty much, really.
You know, it just seems to me, and I don't want to create discord, but you have to be a little, it has to be a little irksome to know what you went through at MSNBC when you came on after 9/11 and started to question the war, and your show lasted 8 months, and you had good ratings. And now you turn on MSNBC, and you see Rachel Maddow, and you see Chris Hayes, mm-hmm. and you see Lawrence O'Donnell. Well, sir, that has to just be a little bit of a turn of the knife, doesn't it?
I think people may not remember. I was replaced by Michael Savage, who would make fun of AIDS victims, one of the first shock jocks. They seemed to want to out Fox Fox at the time, because Fox was reigning then huge ratings over everybody. But they quickly got off that. That was a big mistake. And they went the other way. It's true. And they did invite me back to appear. They certainly didn't give me my job back, but they they invited me. I was a guest on Morning Joe. And I was just not too long ago, a month or 6 weeks ago, I was on MSNBC. I felt like Rip Van Winkle going back to the...
Joy Reid.
Yes. So, you know, to be fired for opposing one of the worst presidential decisions in the history of this country, the invasion of Iraq, I think, actually, I would want my grandchildren to know that's what Grandpa did. He opposed a totally unnecessary, unaffordable, unconstitutional war. and they fired him. Good for you, Grandpa. I mean, that's how I look at it. So I'm not bitter in any way.
You go on and you do that show, and there's two things I want to point out. One, maybe this is a little gossip, but, well, it was Chris Matthews' fault, right? I mean, Chris Matthews had a lot to do with this.
Well, I've been determined not to get into a pee contest.
Yes.
With Chris. I mean, there are people who are coming home dead, even today, from Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think it's a little bit of a waste of time for me to, you know, oh, woe is me. And, you know, Chris has a nice family, and, you know, I think he's a, when he dies, which I hope isn't soon, I think he'll go to heaven. And who knows, maybe I'll meet him there. But, you know, he certainly wasn't helpful. But here we are, and he's got a show, and good for him. He's a very wonky guy. He knows a lot. He worked for, as you know, he worked for Tip O'Neill.
Yes.
You know, he'll tell you how far Humphrey was behind in 84 or whatever it was. He's just very bright, and has a lot of political information, which I hope I would have if I had worked for Tip O'Neill too. So he's an inside politico, and that's a good guy to have on the air.
When you were on the air on MSNBC, you're outspoken, you're looking into that camera, and you're talking against the war and our president. And I find this funny slash sob-inducing at the same time, which is that they wanted you to have two conservatives on.
For every liberal.
For every liberal, but you counted as two.
Yes.
I mean, there's that's amusing. And
it
yet
is. No, it sheds light on the nature of corporate media. You know, if you're a stockholder or even a member of the board of directors of General Electric, one of the five largest defense contractors in the world, they make a lot of things that go boom. They make airplane engines, tanks, a lot of war material. And here you got this gray-haired talk show guy on your own GE-owned MSNBC. And you got a show where a guy is popping off against Rumsfeld, for example, one of their biggest customers. And you take a survey of a focus group, which came up with a memo that was published by the New York Times. Donahue's opposition to the war is not going to work against the flag waving on the other stations. So another thing that conspires to war, flag waving, and corporate media, which is part of the defense establishment, is not going to tolerate dissent. So that was a very difficult and unhappy moment for me, a chapter of my life. But boy, did I learn fast. I never realized it was quite that powerful, but it is.
Talk show host, author, and activist Phil Donahue joins us this morning for this extended chat on the Roundtable on WAMC.
Let me say the obvious to the man who taught me this, you, which was you learned at that point in working for MSNBC that why your television career flourished so well, because you were syndicated. You weren't working for one person, one company. So if you pissed off the guy in Las Vegas, well, so be it. They'll still run you in Albany. They'll still run you in Akron. They'll still run you in Portland.
That's right.
Now, it may be 10% of these stations will go, but you still have 90. And maybe you'll even get some more down the road because of it.
That is true.
Syndication was your friend.
It was a cushion against the reality of network television, where a guy, a vice president, while he's shaving in the morning, can end your career.
Right.
And that is true. In many ways, it's the most honest kind of theatrical distribution for television, collectively, you are able to survive. Those general managers who don't like you or who are upset at your politics, if we had been born on the network, we never would have survived. We just wouldn't have. I mean, the network's not going to. We put a guy in who said, all automobile dealers are crooks. And the entire Miami Valley Automobile Dealers Association canceled the whole station, not just my show, the whole station. So, I mean, now I got seven local salesmen outside my door. You know, one had just lost Rogers Pontiac, another had lost Chevrolet. And that's what syndication can, it gives you a little bit of breathing room. You can survive some of this.
So let me refer to page 198 in your book, published in 1979, Donahue, My Own Story. Shows that were banned, the abortion show, 10% of the total Donahue station lineup found it too graphic, took it off the air. The Birth of a Baby, banned by approximately 5% of your stations, including WEWS, your hometown, Cleveland, too graphic.
One of the most memorable shows we ever did was we televised the birth of a baby at home. And she was in the bedroom of the apartment where the doctor was at hand. Their little four-year-old son, Ben, ran around the room. And as she pushed and pushed, the little kid said,
Mommy, it's a puppy.
A reverse vasectomy and tubal ligation reconstruction banned by WGN in Chicago, correct? Too educational for women and too bloody. Too educational. Can you imagine?
Hi, how are you today?
Good morning.
I was just wondering if a vasectomy is performed, what are the chances of a woman getting pregnant after this, after it's been reversed?
Oh, it's been reversed.
Yes.
Okay, well, it depends upon how it's done. The vas is a very, very delicate, tiny little structure on the inside, though it's very rugged on the outside. So vasectomy is easy. Putting it together is hard.
Parents of Gays banned by WWLP in Springfield, Massachusetts, because it was a touchy issue to be dealt with during the summer months.
I am the mother of a gay son. And are any of you trying to tell me here that my son is a lesser person because he's a homosexual? To ask the people who are concerned with the education of our children, why do you have to place that emphasis on the sexual act? Why can you not teach them that there's a whole range of sexuality? Teach them about loving, teach them about caring, teach them about value.
You had to have gotten quite used to all of that.
Yes, we took our lumps. That's interesting. I didn't realize. WEWS wouldn't air what?
Would not air. Now, let me go back to 198 here. Parents of Gays. Touchy subject. Didn't want to deal with it during the summer.
Right. Gene Autry's station. Gene Autry owned five out west, including K-Gun, I believe, in Arizona.
Yep.
And another station where I auditioned and didn't get the job very early on. One of his stations refused to air Dick Gregory, the comedian. Refused to air him. So we lived through a lot of that. Bob Evans, Farm Sausage,
yep,
sent a letter. This is after we featured Jane Fonda.
Did you call Nixon a murderer?
Oh, well, I'm quoted as saying a lot of things. I saw children, women, old people, homes, churches, schools leveled to the ground.
I will not sponsor any program that tears down America. Simple. That was his. Any program that tears down America. Now, there are proud, church-going Americans out there who believe this. Dissent is un-American. Holy cow, if that catches on. Well, the whole idea of America and free speech is gone.
It never kept you from having Jane Fonda back on. It wasn't like you were going to look at it and say, "Oh, well, we're going to lose Springfield. We're going to lose Gene Autry's station or Bob Evans."
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether I was smart enough to predict that I was going to lose those stations. I certainly didn't believe that Dick Gregory was going to become a lightning rod that they didn't want to air.
But it didn't keep you from doing things that were controversial in the future.
No, it didn't. And a lot of times, the cancellations provided a good show for us. For example, there was a preacher who encouraged all his flock not to watch the Donahue show. And so we immediately put him on. You know, why? What are we doing here? Too much sex.
I went over your list of transcripts that are available. It's an older list, probably outdated, but there are about 225 transcripts listed. And I made a count. And of those 225, what subject do you think appeared most often? See, I don't even say it. They know. 26 transcripts, 26 programs on sex out of the 225.
My guess is that you would call an abortion discussion a sex show.
Well, anything relating to sex, yes. That relates to sex.
My guess also is that if we had discussed the sending of, for example, contraceptive information through the mails, an issue which is now before the United States Supreme Court, you would call that a sex show.
Well,
you're like the guy who goes to a psychiatrist and a doctor,
not at all.
It was a great show. I mean, the show was compelling. I received a letter once from a guy by the name of Phil Donahue. I'm talking too much. There are times when I just like to stuff a sock in your mouth. So obviously we had him on the show. And about 8 minutes in, I gave him a sock, and he stuffed it in my mouth. And I said, we'll be back in just a moment. You know, we did a letters show. Letters where the whole staff would come on, mostly women producers would come on, you know, all the way across the stage, and they'd all have their letters to read. Dear Phil, I have watched your show for the last time, blah, 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 whatever it was, they said. Phil, you should dye your hair. Phil, you should get a haircut. All the complaints that, about individual shows. And it was very, very absorbing to hear what was upsetting people out there. And kind of a door open to the kind of pressure that the office was under.
Two things I want to make mention of. One is the fact that you talked about likability. I mean, your personality, you were somebody we wanted to spend time with. We wanted you in our living room.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true. I had a lot of guests, you know, that made you feel that way.
But they wouldn't be there tomorrow. If you had John Wayne on, he was on Tuesday. He wasn't going to be on Wednesday. But I'll tune in on Wednesday because I want to see you.
By the way, I had John Wayne.
How would you imitate John Wayne?
Just one line.
Well, all right, Pilgrim.
Joe, some of your listeners might challenge your objectivity, but...
Again, we're not related.
We're not related, and I know that must be important for you to make that case, because I certainly don't want to take a nice guy like you over the side with me, and I did promise you that I would behave as long as you did. You spell it right, too. By the way, you may know there's no D-O-N-A-H-U-E's in Ireland. It's all O-Donahue, G-H-U-E. Right. And we aired in Ireland, by the way.
Well, how could you not?
That was a kick.
Our Lady of Angels had to be pleased about that.
I wonder. The nuns prayed mightily for me. And I'm sure upon the occasion of my graduation, they went to church and say, Dear God, we've done everything we could for little Philly now. He is in your hands, and we will continue to pray for him. But I was hardly a model student.
My father, his name was Phil Donahue. And
really?
As in his professional life, he's since passed, but in his professional life, he would have to travel for the federal government and go to such sexy places as Wheeling, West Virginia, and he would make his reservation and under Phil Donahue, and he'd show up, and they're there in lights. Welcome, Phil Donahue.
Really?
And then he'd walk in. Not good. Well,
Somebody once asked me on the air, yes, it was Bob Hope. Somebody asked Bob Hope, Mr. Hope, what is the nicest hotel you've ever stayed in? He named a hotel, I believe it was in Houston, Texas. And I was booked there when I was on my book tour with this memoir of 1979. And I show up and I get out of the car and the bellhops have a little badge on their uniform said, "Thank you, Phil." I walk in and the people behind the desk all have to say, "Thank you, Phil." Every employee in the hotel, the restaurant people, "Thank you, Phil." Because apparently when Bob Hope said that on my show, business shot through the roof. So he talked about the suite, and I stayed in that suite with a piano. So don't get me started, Joe. I mean, I'll take you around the world. It's your fault for booking a talk show host.
You're the absolute best. The reason I wanted to do this all my life is because I watched you. Having an opportunity to sit across from you and talk, especially at this length, is something that is unrivaled for me. I hope you had that opportunity throughout your career to talk to the people who meant so much to you.
Well, I mean, in many ways I did. I didn't have this kind of time, and it seemed to me there was always a floor director with a fist in my face, you know.
Yeah.
And the people in the control room going nuts because I've got commercials I got to get in here. Come on. And in the first segment, if I didn't feel I had a guest who had really sold the value of this person's ideas by the time of the first commercial, I just kept going. And it's not a good thing because then I'd have clutter, you know, too many commercials in too little time.
Phil Donahue, it has been an absolute pleasure and an honor to spend time with you. I am humbled that you would spend so much time with us and share your journey and your knowledge with us.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm not sure I've ever been interviewed by a Donahue, but I don't want to damn you with my praise. Thank you for helping me here. You were wonderful. And let's see. Hopefully we haven't scandalized too many people and that I haven't shortened your very successful reign on the radio. This is a wonderful way to communicate a fabulous, fabulous invention that I happen to be a part of long before I got on television.
Phil Donahue, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
That wraps up our Phil Donahue special. My thanks to Phil Donahue and his office for their assistance. Many thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc, for her outstanding work putting all this together. We'll be back Monday for another edition of the program. Stay tuned now for Brian Shields with Midday Magazine.